Blog Talk Radio.
It's Monday night.
I've been in the game a long time. When a catcher catches a ball and it's strike three, you call the guy out. It's that simple, isn't it?
And if it's Monday, it's the knee jerks.
I'm not going to sit here and rip umpires, but you saw what you saw, clearly saw what you saw. I just saw it for the 10th time. Write it and say something once in a while. Have the nerve to say something.
Detroit Sports Talk with Attitude.
Attitude on this! 1, 2, 3!
Attitude!
Coming up tonight, will Big Al guess whose birthday it is? Who are the jerks of the week? What will Eno rant about now? The answers coming up next. Two guys who know Detroit sports. The voice of reason, Greg Eno and Big Al Beaton.
It's November 20th, 2016, the Sunday before Thanksgiving, and that means time for the Knee Jerks, the Detroit Sports Talk of Eno and Big Al, who have a cornucopia of things to discuss, stuffed menu. Okay, that's enough of the metaphor. my name is Al Beaton, the Alvey Equation. You know, longtime Detroit blogger and podcaster. As always, in me is the... man who has more nicknames than I care to count. He is also, from what I hear, a master turkey chef. That would be Greg Eno well, he'll tell you where you can find all his writing. Greg, another busy weekend.
Thank you, Al Beaton. Happy Thanksgiving ahead of time to everybody out there listening to the program. As Al mentioned, this coming weekend, next weekend, will be my annual famous turkey soup that I make every single year. Al is yet to partake because he and I are so geographically far apart. It's impossible for me to get him any. But it's a delicious soup, and I make it every Sunday after Thanksgiving, so that'll be next Sunday. Fittingly, on the day we're off, so that'll be good. I am on my WordPress blog, as usual, Out of Bounds. Just Google Greg Eno Out of Bounds or Google Greg Eno WordPress, and you'll find my stuff. There, also my Wing Wheeler blog is on WordPress as well, as I write about the Red Wings from time to time. Follow me on Twitter, at Greg Eno. Follow Knee Jerks on Twitter, at The Knee Jerks. Our Facebook fan page is facebook.com/TheKneeJerks, and our blog is TheKneeJerks.us. That's where you can find out about the program. And programming note, tonight it'll just be Al and me pontificating at you about sports for the next hour, hour and a half or so. 2 weeks from tonight will be our next episode on that'd be the 4th of December, I believe. We'll be back at you for, as we hit you with two more episodes before Christmas, the 4th and the 18th, so stay tuned for that. And other than that, we've got full docket. We've got, of course, the Lions game against the Jaguars. We've got some Cy Young and Rookie of the Year stuff to talk about. Oh, woe is our Red Wings. We'll talk about them. And before we get to any of that, though, it's time to play a game we like to call Whose Birthday Is It, Maestro?
We baked you a birthday cake. If you get a tummy ache and you moan and groan and woe, don't forget we told you so.
Happy birthday!
Happy birthday!
Everybody knows how we play this game by now. I give Al a clue or two or three of an individual whose birthday it is today in the world of sports. And Al can correctly guess that person within the first two clues. He'll win some rich Corinthian leather.
You know, that's funny because after my parents divorced, my dad drove a Cordova for a while. So I know exactly what you're talking about. The Cordova doesn't come with it, of course. Or Ricardo Montalban. As well.
Right, Ricardo Montalban. Exactly. that's what's at stake here. If Al can guess this person within the first two clues, our mystery person, Al, was born on this date in 1945, so he's 71 years old today. He made his name in the world of baseball, where he was a left-handed hitting outfielder with some power who broke into the big leagues with the old Kansas City Athletics, I will tell you that. Because I don't think that's going to be too much of a giveaway, but I will tell you that he made way more of his living in the National League than he ever did in the American League, and he was he did something very, well, no, I'm not going to give that clue yet. That's too much. I'll leave it at that. 1945, Kansas City A's in 1966, but left-handed hitting outfielder, but played until 1984, but almost every year in the National League.
Oh, darn. You know, cause at first I'm thinking maybe Reggie Jackson, but no, I'll be since, because you're saying mostly National League. So,
right.
Yeah. So, got to start with the A's, left-handed outfielder. Made most of his noise in the National League. Huh. Jeez. You know, it sounds like you have a couple clues that may just give him away, but, God, you know, there are so many ball players of that ilk, of that era for the most
part.
Right. You know? You know what? I'll just pass on it right now. And since my first guess went out the window of part of your clue, so I'll just wait till after we're done talking Lions to get the second question.
Okay.
All right, with that, let's start talking some Lions. Lions came off their bye week with their, I guess, the second half of the season essentially started for them today. And they beat some low-hanging fruit in the Jacksonville Jaguars. It was a much harder-fought game than I think a lot of people were hoping for or anticipated. 26-19 was the final. With that, the Lions hung on to first place in the NFC North. They are now 6-4. Same record as the Vikings, but they hold a tiebreaker, so they are officially in first place right now. With this win, the Lions have won 5 of 6, 4 straight at Ford Field. And the odd thing about all this, Greg, is that they're constantly playing from behind. And every victory they've had this year, and every game they've played this year, they have trailed in the fourth quarter. Even in this game, it wasn't quite as dramatic of a comeback, but the Lions did score 10 points in the fourth, uncontested, so to speak, to give them the victory. They were down 19-16 entering the fourth. So with that, Greg, as we were talking before we went live with the podcast, it was an ugly, ugly first half, and really part of the second half. There was a ton of three and outs. Essentially, the Lions' offense in the first was three and out for the most part. But they finally got on track about halfway through the third, and they started to look like the team we've been seeing pretty much for the last month and a half. But I guess now with this, I guess the other stat to add to fall and thrown out there is this is their 10th one-score game to start a season, which is a new NFL record, breaking the previous record of 9, which was set by the Lions in their last game. So, you know, if there's proof that there's parity in the NFL, Greg, it's essentially the Detroit Lions are it. They are the poster boys for parity because they're a good team, but they're not a bad team. They're kind of right in that they're going to hover. They're 6-4 right now. And if you look at the score differential, they're right where they pretty much should be, right around 500. But they are on a pretty good hot streak right now. And once again, I think you could put a lot of the reason for this victory on the shoulders of Matthew Stafford, who in the fourth quarter played like, where's this guy been in the first three quarters? But Stafford was solid in the fourth quarter, and really they ended the game how you want to see a team end the game. An 8 minutes long drive, 15 plays. They bled the clock down for almost the second half of the fourth quarter. And by the time the Jacksonville got the ball back, there was about 25 seconds left in the game. Essentially, the game was over. So with that, Greg, what's your thoughts on this? Because there were a lot of ugly things in this game, but there's a lot of positive to take from this game as well, specifically when you talk about the defense and special teams.
You know, this was a classic trap game in the sense that they were coming off, the Lions were a bye, they were playing an inferior team at home days before the big Thanksgiving showdown with the Vikings. You know, game they should win. They were reading for 2 weeks in the papers about how they're in first place and how they've got the division. You know, they're the in the driver's seat to win the division, and they read all that for 2 weeks. And
this was this was a classic same old Lions game. This is how it was hit. That's really what I think a lot of people were expecting.
Yeah, this set up for Lions fans to be disappointed, angry, It just had that setup. I mean, the way it, because normally all those things for most teams would be a positive thing. I mean, off of a bye, guys healed up, play an inferior team at home, get off to a nice start for the rest of the season. You're in first place. You feel good about yourself. All those things would normally be a good thing for a football team. But for the Lions, it just we've seen this before, where these kinds of situations is where they tend to gag. And they started the first half like that's what they wanted to do. Like, it's going to be, one of these, we were all going to be talking about a missed opportunity and how can you lose to the Jaguars at home and forth. And they flirted with that. But it just had to feel, Al, that was going to be what was going to happen. But they got it together, and Jacksonville, fortunately, did just enough things that a 2-17 does that it helped the Lions, pull it out. But they weren't crisp. They looked like they were in a fog in the first, especially in the first half offensively. They just didn't look like they were ready to play football. They looked like that they were had accumulated a rust, in just the 1 week off. Mm-hmm. But it's behind them, and they got it in the right column, and that's all that matters, of course. But it was not by any stretch of the imagination one that you're not gonna frame that one and put it up on the wall. But it's in the left hand column. That's all that matters.
Yeah. In the end, that's what the Lions will point at. They'll say scoreboard when people start giving them a little hard time as to how much they struggle. It really is a bad team. But then the fans could go back with, say what you will, but the running game in this great game was non-existent, literally. They averaged 0.7 yards per carry, under a yard per carry, 14 for 21. They only had 144 yards in the first three quarters. Obviously, that really picked up in the fourth. They ended up with 278, but they were still outgained by Blake Bortles in Jacksonville. They ended up with 285. So, this thank goodness this team did manage to explode. And some of those pieces, I mean, we've been waiting. I think a big one in this one, I think you put who played a big, big part in this game was a guy who's caught a lot of grief from the fan base, but has really become the player I think the Lions thought they were getting when they drafted him 3 years ago. And that's Eric Ebron, because if that's that big 60-yard play in the fourth quarter, that was essentially the backbreaker for Jacksonville. And then he ended up getting the touchdown for a nice little play call with that jet sweep to the tight end, for a yard to get the touchdown. And essentially, that really kind of felt like the game right there. The Lions were able to salt it away with a field goal later on for a nice drive. But when you brought up the point about Jacksonville did enough of the bad things to lose a game, that really turned up in that final drive is when the Lion that was right just past midfield, I think they had 3 or 4 yards to go, and you knew that the Lions weren't going to snap the ball on fourth down, yet they somehow suckered a defensive lineman into jumping, and that essentially allowed the Lions to run out the clock. So there was a lot of good, a lot of bad, but thank goodness the good outshone the bad, at least late in the game, between Stafford, Ebron, and I guess we should also throw a shout out to Andre Roberts, who essentially kept his team in the game with that punt return touchdown in the first half.
Well, you just have Matthew Stafford, Al, just has too many people that he can at his disposal. I mean, he just has too many people. Marvin Jones and Golden Tate and Eric Ebron and Roberts and Theo Riddick out of the backfield and Ebron and there's just too many of them. I mean, there's just too many, and I thought Jacksonville did okay. I mean, defensively, certainly, as you mentioned, they completely shut the run down. There's no question about that. But when push came to shove, Matthew Stafford just had too many weapons at his disposal, and you mentioned the 61-yard pass to Ebron, which of course was a great play by Ebron, but really, that is Matthew. That's an example of two guys who are developing some chemistry. When your quarterback is back there dancing around like that and eluding sacks and jumping up in the pocket and running toward the line of scrimmage to throw, that's when the receivers have to be simpatico, because you can't give up on a route. You can't, you know, you can't do anything but continue on and look for the football. And
yeah.
And that's what Ebron did, and I agree with you 100% about Ebron. I mentioned this a couple weeks ago. This guy is, you know, I was one of his critics. So a lot of us were, you know, and to be fair, he deserved it. I mean, he was, the first 2 years, it was spotty. A lot of drop passes. You know, we didn't care for, maybe his attitude was a little too happy-go-lucky for somebody who hadn't done a whole lot and for somebody who dropped a lot of passes. But this year, he's been very reliable. He's made some tough catches. He's very athletic, as we all know. And, you know, I tell you what, he did indeed make that big catch. But that was Stafford keeping the play alive, a receiver, Ebron keeping the play alive. And that's when it looked like that the Lions were in a little bit of trouble. It was third and, like, I believe it was like 3rd and 14 or something at that point. And, you know, they already had the turnover by Tate, the possession before that.
Right.
And, you know, but what's always good after a turnover is, of course, holding the other team to a 3-and-out, which is what the Lions did after Tate fumbled. So that helped. But, you know, and it was early enough in the fourth quarter, so it wasn't enough. You didn't have to panic. You didn't have to rush anything. But, you know, you mentioned Marks, the guy who jumped off sides at the end of under 3 minutes to go. There was that. There was they gave up a punt return touchdown. They gave up a pick six. That's Bortles. He's done that a bajillion times this year, by the way. Pick six is all over the place. They gave up the Andre Roberts touchdown on the punt return. So those are the things you can't. That's why they're 2-8 now. That's why they're 2-8. Those kinds of things. They couldn't make big play. They couldn't get big first downs when they needed to get first downs. Jacksonville. They. You know, they just didn't have enough. To close it. And the Lions did. And I don't know if this is a good sign or not that they can play like that against a bad football team and still win, or if that was I guess if you're going to look at it like this was, if you're going to have a game where you're going to come out sleepwalking in the first half, then I guess Jacksonville's the team to do it against. Because against any other team, most any other team in the NFL, the Lions may have been down 2-3 scores before they knew what hit them. But fortunately, they were playing a team that isn't any good, so they were able to stay in the game. And I don't think there were a lot of people that really thought that Jacksonville was going to win that game, even though they did take the lead. Because the Lions are better. They're a better team. I mean, they're a better team, and, you know, they're playing at home. And even though it was, still a trap game, they're a better team. And the better team won today.
Yeah, and as they say, there's three phases to the game, and I think in this game it's safe to say special teams played a huge part in this. Between, you know, Sam Martin, if he's not the best kicker, the best punter, I should say, in football, I don't know how many more would be better than him. And Prater as well has just become pretty much automatic, even though he did have a field goal block, not field goal, an extra point block today. The guy's been money when it comes to his field goals. And obviously Roberts had a big return today. And then the defense, of course, probably played one of their better games of the season against a weak opponent, but still in a game where I think this is a game, the Lions easily could have found themselves down 2 or 3 scores, but in this game, the defense and special teams stepped up their game when they needed it to, if sometimes all three phases of the game aren't clicking, some of the other phases got to pick up the other one. In this case, special teams and defense definitely did. Even though it was more that bend, no break crap of the defense, but you can get away with that against a lot of the quarterbacks in this league, you know, and Blake Bortles, say what you will about him. I can't believe that guy's got a multi-year, multi-million-dollar contract, but I'll just put it this way. Even though that offense struggled, after seeing what some of the quarterbacks are doing in this league, between the, we've seen Bortles and guys like that, the report this week that Stafford was looking for $25 million a year, sure as hell isn't all that unreasonable. And I'm about to say, just pay the guy.
No, they wouldn't be where they are, obviously, without him. I mean, he's never going to win over the entire fan base. I mean, no quarterback ever is, unless you're Tom Brady. But, I mean, he's silenced a lot of his critics.
Yeah.
I mean, he has to. I mean, you can't You can nitpick him all you want, but I mean the bottom line is the guy's winning. The Lions would not be anywhere near 6-4 if it wasn't for him.
Mm-hmm.
Really, I mean you can't. You gotta try to look at this through some sort of with some sort of objectivity,
yeah.
And say, you know, I don't care how much of an anti-Stafford guy you were going into the season. You gotta be somewhat reasonable and say, look, this guy is playing the quarterback position at as high of a level as anybody is in the NFL right now. And, you know, you can nitpick and say, well, I don't want to hear more about mechanics, by the way. I don't want to hear anything else. Mm-hmm. And they touched upon it. The broadcast team today, Berline and Tasker and the other guy, touched on it about, you know, when Matthew first came in the league, he was, you know, the people got on him for his mechanics and his unorthodox style and the way he would side out the ball at times. And maybe the first couple of years that was, you know, not to his benefit. But now he's able to pull out. It's like a pitcher who's got a bunch of different pitches. He can pull out different ways to release the football depending on what the need is, depending on how he's being rushed, where he's running, what direction he's running, where the receiver is, you know, all these different factors, he seems to be able to know, you know, how to throw the ball. I mean, you know, how to release it and where to release it. And I don't know what else to say about it. I mean, I'm not going to go crazy here and say that he's the league MVP or he's going to lead the Lions to the promised land, but he's the best thing they've had under center. Let's face it. I mean, here's another thing you got to admit as well. I don't care if you're a Stafford hater or not. He's the best thing the Lions have had under center probably in our lifetime. I mean, you know, with all due respect to the Greg Landers of the world and the Gary Danielses of the world, who Scott Mitchell's, who all had a big year or two, nothing compares to the body of work. And I know it's a passing game, so some of the numbers are not apples to apples. But as far as leadership and confidence and pulling these games out in the fourth quarter and athletic ability and just the whole package that you want out of a quarterback, he's by far, you know, the best. And you could make a case, I'm going to get roasted for this, but you could make a case that he's the best Lions quarterback of all time,
mm-hmm.
including Bobby Lane. And I know that Bobby Lane's got all the championships, on his resume, but as far as a pure passer and ability at the position, Bobby wasn't very he wasn't very sound himself. I mean, he was not a prototypical passer either. But he obviously knew how to get things done and how to make the plays when he needed to make them. But he did not have the raw ability that Matthew Stafford possesses, and now we're starting to see Stafford harness that, and I can't emphasize enough that we're seeing a lot of this coming out, if you will, this breakout year from him, if you will, precisely because Calvin Johnson retired. I submit to you that if Calvin Johnson was still on this football team, I don't think the Lions would be 6-4, and I don't think Stafford would be having the kind of year he's. I could be wrong, but I really believe that not having Johnson there was kind of like a burden lifted off of Matthew Stafford's shoulders, and he can just go out there now and treat all the receivers the same and not have to worry about trying to force-feed this all-pro future Hall of Famer. And he can just go out there and just spread the ball around. I've never seen him spray the ball around like he is this year. Never, not even close.
Yeah, and just to drive that point home about Bobby Lane, he led the NFL in pass completion percentage in 1955, 53%. And that was his best year. Usually he was under 50 if you look at his entire career. Just shows how it's a different era, different game, different type of athletes playing now and playing that position. But, again, at this point with Stafford, there's just no way you let the guy walk. And the fact that, you know, the rumor that came out this past week that when the extension talks come up and it's going to happen after the end of the season, that he was looking to get 25 a year, and obviously long term, we're probably talking somewhere from 5 to 7 years, maybe even longer, is that it's not that big of a bump in salary, because I believe his salary cap hit right now is $22 million because of those that ridiculous rookie contract before they had the slotting system, and the fact that they had to do a lot of contract rejiggering, reshuffling of the numbers to be able to keep guy like Ngamuk and Sue as long as they did, so on and so forth. So, and it's just quarterback is such a crapshoot, Greg. I mean, we've seen it here for decades with first round picks that flamed out, that undrafted, free agents who got stuck into the situation flamed out. Guys who were middle round picks flamed out. And so when you finally have a guy who, you know, is he elite? That's a goofy question at this point. Who cares? Look at the numbers. He's really, 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 really good. And the Lions are winning with him. I won't call them winners yet, but they are winning games with him. You pay the guy and you worry about other positions, because if there's one position in sports that can absolutely keep a franchise afloat or turn a franchise around, it's having a quality quarterback at the NFL level. If you don't have that, well, you see what Blake Bortles, who was a first-round pick, a number three overall pick, who was throwing ducks up there today. I can't believe he was only picked off the one time. He should have been picked off three or four. So,
right.
You know, I'm just, you know, the crapshoot you have a quarterback in the draft, it's, you know, once you have a quarterback, you literally do whatever you can to keep him from leaving, and that usually means backing up the Brinks truck, and then you let the chips fall where they may. It's just what you have to do.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And I look at it this way: if you were starting an expansion team, if you were starting a fantasy football team, either one, who would be the first position you would look for a quarterback? I mean, if you were starting a team from scratch, and you could dictate where you wanted your best player to be, you would want your best player to be quarterback, okay? And we're always told that quarterback is arguably the most important position in any team sport, arguably. You can make a case that the quarterback position is the most important of any singular position in any major sport. You can make that argument. So if that's the case, and if you ask a poll a lot of NFL general managers, where would you begin your expansion team? I would tell you that most of them would say I'd start at quarterback and work and build from there. And so you're absolutely right. When you find a guy, now it doesn't mean you're going to win a Super Bowl with this particular person, but when you find a guy who's, like you said, leading you to victory, is without question your best player, is your best leader, and you haven't had that at that position for decades. You would be absolutely derelict in your role to not do whatever you could to keep that player. I mean, Matthew Stafford should retire a Lion. I mean, just like Ndamukong Suh should have retired a Lion, just like Calvin Johnson did retire a Lion, just like Barry Sanders did retire a Lion, and so on. Matthew Stafford ought not to wear any uniform ever again. I mean, it would be a sin. And, you know, I don't care what you still have 52 other guys that you have to build, you know, have a team with. But if you have what you, let's put it this way. There are 30, I don't know, maybe not 30, certainly, but 20, I would tell you at least 25 other teams anyway in the NFL right now that would trade their quarterback for Matthew Stafford without, they do it in a nanosecond.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there might be five or six that wouldn't. You know, Green Bay, New England, maybe Seattle, Pittsburgh. You know, not too many. Once you get past those four, you know, even Dallas, what they're doing now with that kid. I mean, if you're going to trade a kid, would they trade a kid to get to Matthew Stafford? I think they would.
Mm-hmm.
I think they would. So, you know, there's not too many teams in the NFL, Al, that would not trade their quarterback for Matthew Stafford. So that's just a fact. I mean, that's not my opinion. You can hate on him all you want, but that's the fact. Now, will the Lions ever win a Super Bowl with him? I don't know. Will he be the reason that they don't? I don't think so. I think at this point, the reason will be not because of him. It'll be because they weren't able to have a running game, or they weren't able to have a big-time playmaker on defense, or there'll be something else. But I don't think, you know, would he be another John Elway until Elway won the Super Bowl? Would he be another Marino? I don't know. But all I know is that once they gave Elway a running attack and once they the defense around him, he won, guess what? He won two Super Bowls, and of course at an advanced age, but he did do it.
Yeah, it's I think that pretty much encapsulates the whole thing when it comes to the quarterback. It's such a huge difference maker at the NFL level. It's, once you have one, you keep him, pure and simple. You know, you don't let one of the few times that has happened in our recent memories when Drew Brees was allowed to walk because they happened to have Philip Rivers in their hip pocket there in San Diego. But that, you know, that's, the Lions don't have a Philip Rivers sitting on the bench here in Detroit. You know, and you know, it's and that's why you hire a general manager. You know, that's why Bob Quinn, his job is to make sure he keeps his franchise quarterback and then builds a team around him with the money he has available. So far, so good. You know, they are 6-4. They are on top of the division, and huge game on Thanksgiving Day, Greg. The Vikings coming to town. They're essentially tied at the top, except the Lions right now hold the tiebreaker. A lot of big implications for this game. You know, national television, obviously, being the early Thanksgiving Day game. Short rest. Division opponent. Division, make an argument, division title may just be on the line here. But at the very least, first place is on the line. Right. And really, this is the... a huge spotlight game for the Lions, and this is a game where they really have to come up big. And we can't see, as we've seen far too often, even this year, the team come out not hitting on all cylinders for 30 minutes or more. Say what you will about the Vikings. You know, they broke their losing streak, their 4-game losing streak, with a victory today over the Cardinals, who aren't a half bad team. Now, this is a game, the Vikings got to be pointing toward us. They'll get a little bit of revenge, win on the road, division on the line, so on and so forth. But this really could be the defining game. And making declarations like this, but realistically, this could be the defining game for the Detroit Lions this season. I mean, there is so much on the line. Come on, we're getting down to the last quarter of the season, just about. We're 10 games in, only 6 to play. So, you know, this game here, because I don't see this team pulling off a wild card. I mean, I'm really starting to look like win the division or bust. The implications of losing this game could really make for a very ugly offseason. This is a game the Lions have to win, pure and simple.
You know, this sets up an interesting situation too, Al, for the remainder of the season in terms of what will happen to the coaching position. You know, we were talking way back in the early part of the season when the Lions were 1-3, and you know, I wrote a piece where I said, you know, I don't think Bob Quinn would make a coaching change in the middle of the season, but I do think that he would seriously consider making one at the end of the season, unless the caveat there was that unless Jim Caldwell, you know, pulls a rabbit out of his hat, essentially, and they win a division, win a playoff game, and it's going to be – then how do you not bring him back? How do you not bring Jim Caldwell back? So short of that, I didn't think that Jim Caldwell would be back. Well, you know, if the Lions do indeed come up and win this division, which is certainly there for the taking, I don't know why or how Bob Quinn could make a coaching change. I really don't. I don't know how you win a division. Host a playoff game. Now you could, you know, if they lose that playoff game, I guess you could say, well, you know, we hosted a playoff game, we should win it, therefore the coach is going to get fired. But I don't know. I mean, after a 1-3 start, if they come back and win the division, they were not picked to win, of course, at the beginning of the year. I don't know. I don't know that you can, even if you lost a playoff game, I don't know that you could get rid of the coach. But that, you know, obviously that's going to take care of itself. But back to your point about how big of a game this is, of course it's a huge game. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, this is one of the biggest games the Lions have played at this time of the year in a long time because of the implications of the specter of winning the division and already holding the tiebreaker over the Vikings. So this would really put a hammer lock on that. If they win this one, they'd go two up in the standings, or one up in the standings, but two up in the tiebreaker, essentially. So, yeah, that's huge right then and there. So it's, you know, maybe it was good now that the Lions had this rinky-dink component here to kind of get them out of that bye malaise. And then maybe it's good also that they're coming right back and playing in 4 days, because I don't know that they needed another week off after what we saw today. I think this is probably a good time. If there's a good time for a Thanksgiving Day game, physically and as far as a preparation, as far as a let's get back, I think the Lions would love to go out tomorrow and play another football game based on how they play for the most of the day today. So I think this is a good time for this Thanksgiving Day game to occur. Get right back out there 4 days later. Wash that Jacksonville thing out of your mouth, even though you won the game. You everybody can look in the mirror and say, we didn't wake up until the third quarter. Well, you do that against the Vikings on Thanksgiving. I don't care how much the Vikings have been struggling lately. It's not going to be the same thing as against Jacksonville. So maybe it was good they got that out of their system and now get ready to play a big football game on Thursday. No trap game, nothing like that. And it's just all it is now, it's a big football game, and that's all it needs to be. And it should be exciting.
Yeah, say the least. And always in the back of our minds as Lions fans, you know, there's parallels to 2013 here, where the Lions really looked at that point in 2013, they were 6-3, looked like they had the division. It was theirs for the taking, especially, I believe that was the season where the Packers lost their quarterback, Chicago lost their quarterback. And really, it fell into the Lions' lap.
Right.
And then
right.
Jim Schwartz's team finished the season, I think 1-6, 1-7, and the that was it. You know, and Schwartz was fired at the end of the They went 1-6 over the last seven. Schwartz was fired, and that ushered in the Jim Caldwell era. So. You know, it's who knows what could happen if they lose this game, you know, because, again, this is a team really playing on the edge. But right now they're on the good side of that edge. Let's hope it stays that way. All right, Greg.
If they come out on Thursday and just have a dominating type performance where they go out there, and I know Minnesota's a pretty good team. If they go out there Thursday and just really make a statement – and blow the Vikings out or beat them handily, that'll do a lot for a lot of people, and it would they could shake that albatross off their back of, well, we can only win if we're down in the fourth quarter. They need to come out one of these games now and really just beat a team really good.
Yeah.
Just really, you know, dominate from beginning to end, win by two or three scores, and never have the game in doubt. They need that for a lot of reasons. I mean, I know they'll tell you, well, we thrive on this pressure. We're best when we have our backs to the wall and all that stuff. But no team likes – you can't tell me that you'd rather do that than have a game where you're in control the whole game. I mean, and the Lions haven't had that. They haven't played a game yet in their first 10 where they've been in control the whole way. And it's great that they've won a lot of these games. Mm-hmm. But they need to come out one of these – sooner or later, they got to come out. And just say we're the better team, and we're in our building, and this is for the division. We smell the division, and we're going to go out there. We're going to kick your ass, and that's what they need to do. And they haven't done that yet. This is a perfect opportunity. I don't care who they're playing, if they're playing the Cowboys or the Patriots. This is an opportunity now to go out there on Thursday, and just take control and be in control. And have Matthew Stafford wearing a baseball cap in the fourth quarter. That's what they need to do. Now, whether that'll happen, I don't know. But that's what they need to do, because you can't continue to roll these dice every week and continue to tell yourself that you're going to come from behind and win in the fourth quarter, because it's going to bite you in the you-know-where sooner or later.
Yeah, remember when Rip Hamilton would say during the Pistons run, "No, if it ain't rough, it ain't right." That's bullshit. I'm tired of that, to say the very least. So it would be nice if the Lions could just put a whooping on somebody, and they've been known to do it on Thanksgiving. We've seen some big victories on Thanksgiving Day. We've also seen some horrible losses, but. If the Lions come out swinging, very often it's on Thanksgiving Day, because, again, it's a showcase game for them. All right, Greg, before we start talking a little Red Wings, why don't you get the question two of the birthday game?
Sure. Born in 1945, broke in with the Kansas City A's in 1966, left-handed hitting outfielder with some pop, but made most of his career, which lasted until 1984, in the National League, where he was an outfielder. He also hit a huge home run that broke the hearts of many a Canadian baseball fan, I will tell you that. And he was a pretty patriotic guy. I'll leave it there.
Okay, I think I know what you're talking about now. Does it involve rescuing a flag from being burned at Wrigley Field, I believe? And that would be Rick Monday, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it was at Dodger Stadium, actually. Dodger Stadium.
Right. But he was with the Cubs at the time.
He was with the Cubs at the time, that's right. He would, of course, later play for the Dodgers. Mm-hmm. But Rick Monday, who, while with the Dodgers, broke the hearts of Expo fans all the world over. In Game 5, with the deciding game of the 1981 NLCS, when he had a home run on a Monday afternoon off Steve Rogers in the ninth inning to lead the Dodgers to a winning. Fans to this day call that Blue Monday. And to this day, Rick Monday, his name is Mud in Montreal. To this day, even though they don't have a baseball team anymore, completely broke their hearts, the Expos. That's the closest the Expos ever came to playing the World Series. Rick Monday, 71 years old today, became a broadcaster. And you're right, saved the American flag in 1976, didn't Scully with the famous call and at Dodger Stadium and Monday, who eventually was presented with that flag, by the way, years later, which is pretty cool. So anyway, Rick Monday, 71 years old today, so Al will receive rich Corinthian leather. So good job.
I can't wait to, just feel it, and then I'll try to roll my R's like Ricardo Montalban. All right. With that, let's move away from football. As my text goes off, I'm sure that's probably my mother bugging me for no reason, and it's too far away for me to reach, so I just keep talking through it. All right, Greg, we got to talk some Red Wings because we haven't really talked about them much since I believe we had Matt Hutter give us his season preview a few weeks ago, and here we are. Not even a quarter of the way into the season, but there's a big date coming up in the NHL season. It's a date that Ken Holland has always said it's a target. If you're at a certain spot in the standings by this date, you are in pretty good shape. And that date is essentially Thanksgiving weekend, Thanksgiving Day. And the standings mean if you aren't in a playoff spot by that point, you're in deep trouble. Well, if that's true, Greg, the playoff streak is already in serious jeopardy because, over the past couple of weeks, Greg, actually been longer, about 3 weeks now, about 13, 14 games now, this team has been brutal. They're 2-7-1 over the past 10 games. They've been outscored 30-17, shut out three times. They're playing right now, and they're tied 1-1 at Calgary. So at least they scored a goal. That's a plus. But the power play is clanking along at 14%. The penalty kill is only 75%. And worse, they only have 17 points on the season. There are 8-9-1 overall. That has them 7th in the Atlantic, 13th overall in the East, and that is also way out of playoff positioning. And if you look at the numbers overall, if you aren't in playoff position by the time Thanksgiving rolls around, only about a quarter of those teams didn't make the playoffs. So, at this point, Greg, it's not a good team. And unfortunately, it's not so much as we feared coming into the season, the defense or even the goaltending. It's been the offense. The offense has been literally non-existent. And as we were kind of chatting before we started recording, the top six, I don't know if they even have a top six the way they're playing right now. They're all playing like fourth line players. It's awful right now.
Right.
And the fact that if guys like Nyquist and Tatar, or for that matter, someone like Zetterberg, these guys aren't producing at the level that is needed and at the rate they're being paid. And if a switch doesn't get turned soon, Greg, I have a feeling the next, you know, a couple months from now, we won't be talking about playoffs. We'll be talking about tanking.
Before I give you my opinion, let me read to you what Matt Harder just texted me. They stink on ice, no identity, and constantly guessing shift after shift. They look like a beer league team.
I can't argue that at all.
Yeah, it's hard to argue with that with Matthew, but I would tell you that he's right on when he says no identity. And this is something we talked about, you and I talked about, even over the summertime. We didn't know, it was all about direction and where they were headed and what, and we did talk about identity as well. And, mm-hmm. you made a good point as well about this, who's the top six? You know, there's a number of, and you chronicled in the show notes, the slumps these guys are in. I know it's like a baseball team that's in a hitting slump, and I know the teams break out of it. I get it, but, you know, we're not talking, at least if you're talking about the Tigers, they're hitting slumps. They've got a bunch of guys whose resumes would tell you that they're pretty good hitters, but the Red Wings have a bunch of guys that are, you know, their resumes aren't great, or in recent years haven't been that great. And, you know, Franz Nielsen is turning out to be a huge bust. Yet another free agent signing that's turning out to be a huge bust. And as luck would have it, their other big free agent signing, Thomas Vanek, has been injured. Steve Ott has been maybe their best free agent signing, which is crazy. I mean, it just haven't been able to get anybody going for any length of time. And you know, even Dylan Larkin he's been invisible. Riley Sheahan is completely invisible.
No goals at all.
And the power play, of course, whenever you're in a slump like that, of course, the power play is going to be bad as well. And the penalty killing, the power play, the special teams in general aren't very good. If it wasn't for some outstanding goaltending by both of these guys, by both Mrazek and Howard, especially Howard, I don't know where the Red Wings would be. I mean, they stole a couple of games on that six-game winning streak that were completely stolen by the goalies, and they had no business winning those games. But right now, Al, they're just I fear they're worse than I thought they were. Now, granted, there's still a lot of Thanksgiving rule or not, there's still lots of hockey to be played. I mean, you know, there's 60 games to play. Let's not go crazy here.
Right.
But I think 20 games, roughly 20 games, is a decent enough sample size to kind of formulate an opinion. Now, is it going to be the same opinion as what we will have come February or March? I don't know. But I do know that from what we've seen so far, this team badly needs a guy who can put the puck in the net and kind of settle everybody down. Washington, teams like, you know, with Ovechkin and, you know, Tampa with Stamkos, whenever you have a guy like that, Al, in your lineup, even when the other guys are slumping, you know that guy is going to put the puck in the net, because those guys usually don't go into slumps. So it takes the pressure off a lot of people when they know they've got at least one guy that's going to go out there and skate 15, 20 minutes a night, who's going to, you know, be able to put the puck in the net. And, you know, sometimes you can get caught up in just watching that person do that and not do it yourself. But the Red Wings don't have that. They don't have anybody, Al, that they can lean on for offense right now. There's nobody in that lineup where you can say, well, thank God we've got so-and-so, because we know he'll score. And now it's just a matter of us doing our part. Red Wings don't have that. They don't have a guy that they can point to and say everything's going to be okay because we have so-and-so. And everybody looks at each other, and consequently, everybody tries to do too much, and you hold the stick a little bit too hard, a little bit too tight, and, you know, again, it's like a baseball team in a slump. Everybody tries to hit a home run. Everybody tries to hit a three-run homer. And, you know, and they've lost a lot of low-scoring games because they haven't been able to score. They lost a 1-0 game the other night in where were they? Where they lost 1-0? Washington.
Yeah.
The other night they lost 1-0.
Gave it away in the last minute. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's just been these goalies have been playing their buns off, and they haven't really been rewarded. They can't score on the power play. They don't have any and back to Matt Hunter's term, they don't have any identity. And back to what you were saying, you know, they got a bunch of guys that don't really know if we don't know if they're top six guys or not. It's a mess. And it just it's what we all thought could happen, but I think this is the extreme of what we thought could happen.
Yeah, it's and just to kind of drill home just how rough it's been for the goalies. Jimmy Howard has a goal against of 1.7, yet he's only 4-4. You know, with a goal against like that, he should be damn undefeated. But you know, he's losing
right. He's
losing games 1-2-1. So. You know, this and you make a great point when you're talking about, you know, they need there's that guy that they could lean on. You know, for years with this team, Greg, there's been a couple guys, you know, specifically like one on defense, I think you know what you're talking about, and a few on offense who made everybody they played with better, made them a threat.
Right.
You know, such as a Nick Lidstrom, for example. Whoever played next to Lidstrom looked like an all-star just because he was so damn good. Well, the Wings the Wings we're watching right now, they don't have, you know, a guy who makes other people better. You know, like Matthew Stafford, as we were talking about earlier, he's making guys around him better. He's putting them in positions to succeed by getting them the ball in the right spots. You know, it's that kind of thing. And especially on offense, Dylan Larkin may end up being that guy, but at 19, he's not there yet. You know, he's going to be a good player. But, for example, it's already been shown right now he's still having trouble being a center, so they put him back on, I believe, on the wing because he's just more effective there right now at his age. So, you know, and the one guy who used to be like that, well, the two guys that used to be like that, Zetterberg is just old and decrepit at this point, and Pavel Datsyuk is in Russia now. So without the guys at that level, this team is now a bunch of third liners struggling to find someone who can put them in a position to succeed, and that guy isn't there.
You know, we all hoped, Al, this isn't much of a plan. I mean, you know, Kenny Holland's got to own some of this as well, but the plan, the nearest that you and I could figure, the plan was, let's just hope one of these guys, i.e. Tatar, Nyquist, Sheahan, you know, Advocator, Larkin to a degree. Let's hope that one of these guys can take the next step, right? That seemed to be the plan. I mean, if you want to call it a plan, that's what it was. Let's hope that one of these guys, you mentioned Zetterberg being old, that's true. You mentioned Datsyuk being in Russia, that's true. So the hope was, okay, we're going to sign Danik, and Danik was pretty good until he got hurt.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be honest. Signed Danik, they signed Nielsen, and Nielsen's been a bust, and Danik got hurt. But even with those guys signed, the game plan seemed to be, well, let's hope these guys take the next step, because it was time for them to take the next step. They've been in the league for, you know, as regulars in the lineup for 3 or 4 years, and, you know, none of them by themselves were great stars, but we thought that maybe together, if they could all kind of take that next step together, the Red Wings could kind of have a top six by committee, if you will, and not really have a stud guy, but have a solid group of forwards that, when working together as a, you know, where the sum was greater than the parts, then that could suffice. Well, unfortunately, that's not happening. Clearly. I mean, none of that is happening. Nobody's taking the next step. If anything, they're all regressing at the same time, unfortunately. Nobody's you know, taking the bull by the horns, if you will. And, I think you're right about, to a degree, when you talk about Lidstrom and you talk about Datsyuk making people better, and everybody you pair with Lidstrom looked like an all-star because he was so good. I'll buy into that a little bit, but sooner or later, you are what you are. I mean, you are what you are, and you know, you could still see the difference between putting somebody like a Brian Rafalski with Lidstrom and somebody who wasn't Brian Rafalski. You could still tell the difference no matter how good Nick Lidstrom was.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to have the Red Wings so badly needed, and I feel bad for Ken Holland. I really do. I mean, I've gotten on his case. you know, as you know, many, 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 many times. But I'm both on this program and on my blog. But, you know, I feel bad for him because these guys just aren't – they're letting him down. They're letting him down. They're letting him down. They're letting Jeff Blashill down. You know, these are – you know, these weren't great players, but they weren't expected to be this bad either.
Mm-hmm.
And I think and I feel badly for Kenny about that because this was not what he envisioned these guys were going to do. Now, again, there's still lots of time, 60-some-odd games left. For better or for worse, there's 60 games left. So, you know, one of them could rise, but Al, it gets to a point now where you've been in the league for 4 or 5 years, like some of these guys have been longer in some cases, and you haven't done it. You know, it's time to say, you know, it's not going to happen.
Right.
And so that's where it gets tricky for a GM. You know, where do you cut bait? When do you say, okay, Gus Nyquist, it's not going to happen. Okay, Tomas Tatar, you're not very good. Okay, Riley Sheehan, maybe you were a draft bust. You know, sooner or later, you've got to make these decisions about these guys and say, look, you know, it's just not happening. But that's not even the easiest part. That's not even the hardest part. The hardest part is then once you make that decision, determining what are you going to do next? Are you going to trade them? What kind of trade value are these guys? These guys don't have any trade value. You're not going to get anything. You're going to get a bucket of pucks for these guys right now. You can't trade them. You're stuck with them. So, you know, nothing's going to happen, Al, during the course of this season, I don't think, that's going to drastically change the course of this team's direction. You're just going to have to live with what you have, hope that they get better. But as far as, you know, making changes, it's not just as easy as say, well, at the end of the year, I'll trade all these guys and just get new guys. No, because the rest of the NHL is not going to take these guys off your hands unless it's for very little.
Yeah.
And you're not going to get a lot back for these. You know, if you shop around Tatar, Nyquist, Sheehan, and even Avdekator right now, you're not going to get anything. You're not going to get anything that's going to make any impact whatsoever. At best, you'd be making a tit-for-tat trade where you'd be trading somebody, you'd be getting somebody else's problem for your problem. And you just would just be hoping against hope that the problem you traded for is going to be rejuvenated by changing scenery. You're not going to make some blockbuster trade right now and package these guys together and get some playmaker. It's just not going to happen. So, you know, I hate to just write the season off in mid-November, but I just don't know where there's anybody out that's going to emerge and save and kickstart this offense. I just don't know where it's going to come from.
Yeah, it's and the other thing, you know, this team is lacking offense, yet they keep running the OMG line, as into oh my God, why are they aligned? Obviously, the Ott, Glendening, Miller line, who they don't generate any offense, and they're very shaky defensively. You know, as I looked at tonight's stats, guess who was on the ice for the one goal to give up tonight? The OMG line. So, it's stuff like that has really gotten me questioning how this team was built, because they are playing guys like, you know, Ott, Miller, you know, Glendening I can see, you know, but you can't have 5 Glendenings on your roster like the Wings seem to have right now. And because of that, they keep bouncing guys up and down like Mantha, Bertuzzi, Avanisu, you know, the usual suspects. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, they promoted Glendening to number one line.
Yeah, and then he's down back to the first line.
Can you imagine the Red Wings back in the day saying, okay, Chris Draper's our number one center?
Yeah.
Can you imagine that? That's essentially what they're doing. They're bumping Luke Glendening, who they never should have re-signed, they should never have signed into that big extension to begin with. It was another example of the Red Wings bidding against themselves.
But now they're bumping him up. Oil to a fault problem they have. That's the thing.
They're putting him on the first line. Of course, I don't know how long that's going to last.
Yeah. Well, you know, but that's the silly part of everything is that I have a feeling that shows right there that Jeff Blashill doesn't have any solutions and that he's throwing shit at the wall now when you do stuff like that.
Of course. Absolutely. There's no, and you can't blame. I'm not. I'm, you can't blame Blashill. You can't get mad at Blashill about that. I mean,
yeah.
he can only play who he plays. And, you know, he's, hey, these guys are in miserable slumps. And it's, again, I'll go back to my baseball analogy.
Mm-hmm.
When a baseball team's not hitting, everybody wants to fire the hitting coach, fire the manager. Well, that doesn't, it has nothing to do with it. You can fire all the hitting coaches you want and fire all the managers you want. It's not going to snap guys out of slumps. Hitting slumps are like the common cold. Everybody gets them, but you really just have to wait them out and let them run their course, just like the common cold. And you can change coaches all you want. You can fire Blashill if you want, today if you wanted to, after tonight's game if you wanted to. It's not going to change, more than likely. It's not going to make it's not going to make Tomas Tatar go on a scoring spree. It's not going to make Gustav Nyquist a 40-goal scorer. It's not going to make Riley Sheahan, to wake him up. It's just not. Now, I know sometimes you do that out of desperation. You fire the coach and you try something new. But all Blashill can do is, like you said, juggle lines,
yep.
Throw stuff against the wall. And, I know that's kind of a crude, way of putting it, but it's true. I mean, when you're putting Luke Glendening on the first line and saying the reason I'm doing it is because we need to be harder on the puck, well, something's wrong. I mean, that's absolutely something is wrong when your number one line has to be injected with a Luke Glendening to get it going. I mean, that's an indictment on the other guys on the line. It's an indictment on the roster, and it's an indictment on Kenny Holland. But again, I feel bad for Kenny because some of these guys are woefully underperforming, and you can fire the coach all you want. I just don't think you're going to bring anybody in who's going to just wave a magic wand and make this team into a playoff contender. So I think you just have to ride it out. Maybe make all your wholesale changes next summer. I don't even know what those would be. I mean, that's a long way off. But I just don't think there's anything, Al, that you can do right now. That's true of hockey in general. Once a hockey season starts, there's not a lot you can do while it's going on to appreciably help your team. It's just so hard to do anymore. With salary caps and things, it's so hard to make an impactful trade or anything to really make a difference. So that's why the Thanksgiving rule is in place, because once you do get to that point, you kind of are past the point of no return.
Yeah. I think you nailed it, though, when you finally said at some point you just have to accept the player is who he is. They are what they are, as they say. And I think we've reached that point. I think of guys like Tatar and Nyquist. They are what they are, and they're the kind of player that is essentially a dime a dozen in today's NHL.
Right.
Can't afford to overpay those kind of guys or give them long contracts. And unfortunately, I think the Wings have gotten themselves stuck in a few of those. And I just brought up some of the numbers here on the Red Wings, and there's some, plus minus isn't obviously a be-all end-all, but it gives you kind of a good idea of how a guy's doing.
Yeah.
Riley Sheahan's a minus 10 this season. Actually, it's now a minus 11.
Wow.
Dylan Larkin's a minus 7. Nielsen's a minus 6. Drew Miller's a minus 5. Tatar's minus 4. Cronwell, who barely played, he's minus 4. your number one defenseman, Danny DeKeyser, is minus 2. So now this is a team, Greg, that if they don't turn things around soon, we're already saying they're in trouble. They got to figure stuff out. But if they don't get this ship turned around, it's going to turn into the Titanic, and I don't think the fan base is going to put so much blame on Jeff Blashill. They're just going to start screaming for Ken Holland's head. Even though I don't ever see him getting fired from this organization, I can just see a fan. I won't know if I could say a fan revolt, but there will definitely be there will be some anger about this team. That this team has gotten so. I'll put it this way: this team built up so much benefit of the doubt in this fan base. Unfortunately, over the last 2 or 3 years, they've about burned it all up with a lot of more than any, not so much as the the on ice play. They've been, they made playoffs, but with the building of the roster and how this team is going to look 2-3 years down the line, because, hockey fans, if you ask me, really are, when it comes to the sport itself, probably the most educated fans You know, they, because they usually tend to be the most diehard, because in a lot of ways, hockey's a niche sport. They, Red Wings fans know a bad contract when they see it. They know throwing good money after bad. And the past 2 or 3 years, that's all this team has seen to do when it comes to building this roster, is just throw good money after bad. And all of a sudden now they're up against the salary cap and they can't afford to do any kind of roster juggling at all unless someone goes on long-term injured reserve. Otherwise, what we see is it. They can't even make a trade at the point unless it's dollar for dollar. And when you find yourself in that position, you really are behind the eight ball.
You know, what's so ironic about this, Al, is that the Red Wings fan, you mentioned it, you hit on it a couple of seconds ago when you said that they've built up so much of the benefit of the doubt, so much equity over the years, and they're frittering it away. But what's so ironic is they really would have, this fan base, I believe, really would have been forgiving if 3 or 4 years ago the Red Wings said, you know what? This is going to be kind of a tough pill. We're going to go with the kids. We're going to go with the kids. We're going to go young. When these older players start to, you know, we're going to do a phase out. You know, when Nick Lidstrom retired, that probably was the point where they should have probably took a different look at things. And it sounds like I'm playing the hindsight game here.
Right.
And maybe I am to a degree, but I think that, you know, I think I was kind of thinking this way anyway back then. I think that might have been that was kind of like, to me, the bellwether to say, okay, this is where maybe. Now I know we saw at that point they still had Tadatsuk, they still had Zetterberg, they still had a younger Cronwall, but that might have been the point where I think the fans would have been forgiving if the Red Wings would have said you're gonna see a lot more kids than you've ever seen before, they're gonna play more than you've ever seen them play before, and we're gonna kind of sink or swim with these kids. We believe in them. We believe in our scouting staff. Look at what our scouting staff has done over the last 20, 25 years. Why wouldn't we believe in our scouting staff? We've got this because the scouting staff has built up a lot of equity as well. I mean, they deserve a lot of the benefit of the doubt too. So why not say, you know, we believe and we trust our scouts and we trust our program in Grand Rapids and our feeder program, and we feel like that. Yes, it's a little bit early than we normally would make these kids Red Wings, but we feel like in today's modern game with the way the finances are and the way the salary cap is and yada, 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 that this is our best path to sustainability. Now, I think the fans it would have been a little bit of pain because they've been used to winning all those years, of course. But I think what you're seeing now, Al, is there's almost a begging and a pleading from the fan base to let these kids play. Mm. Bring the Bertuzzis up and let them go. Bring the Athanasius up and just put them in line up and leave them alone. Let these guys, Mantha and these guys, just play them. Sproul and, you know, Marchenko, all these guys, just let them play. You know, and if they miss the playoffs, miss the playoffs. I mean, who cares? Just let them play, and that's what's so ironic. And here's the other ironic thing.
Yeah.
Steve Ott, you know, you and I have talked for many years about how the Red Wings have been losing out on big-time free agents, summer after summer after summer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, isn't it funny that the one guy that was thrilled to sign a Red Wings contract was Steve Ott?
Yeah.
Oh, I can't wait to put on a Red Wings jersey because I guess he grew up in Windsor or whatever.
Right.
And was always rooted for the Red Wings ever since he was a kid and wanted to put on the winged wheels since he was a teenager. And so, you know, he's the Red Wings jersey. Isn't that almost cruelly ironic that the one guy that is just would love is basking in the glory of playing for the Red Wings is a tomato can like Steve Ott. I mean, it's just really sad that they couldn't get, and that just speaks to why they weren't able to get Shea Weber back in the day. They weren't able to get Suter back in the day. They weren't able to get Stamkos. They weren't able to get on and on and on. Because the Red Wings just, you know, you can say that they're a great organization all you want, and they're first class and all that other stuff. It's great. But athletes want to win.
Yeah.
And they no longer look at the Red Wings as a viable path to that coveted Stanley Cup. Because all these players we're talking about, every single one of them, have not won the Stanley Cup yet.
Yeah.
And that's what they want.
Mm-hmm.
And if they, you know, what they do, they respect the rubbings as an organization. I'm sure they do. Do they respect the tradition? Of course. Do they respect the fact they've won four Stanley Cups since 1997? Of course. But it's all about right now. And right now, they are nowhere near the conversation for a Stanley Cup contender. So why would they come here?
Yeah, exactly. And to go back to your Ott analogy, no, Steve Ott is thrilled to be a Red Wing, and yet the fan base looks at Steve Ott and says, his signing is what's wrong with this current team.
Right.
Oh my God! What are you doing, Ken Holland? All right. Let's hit the home stretch of this podcast, Greg, because we do have to talk about the other controversy that hit town this week, and that was, well, there was awards voting in Major League Baseball, and yeah, in the long run, they don't mean a lot, maybe other than building up your Hall of Fame resume. And Michael Fulmer got off to a great start. He was uncontroversial vote, pretty much the acclaimed, I guess I should say. There was no question he was going to win it. He did. Michael Fulmer, the Tigers starting pitcher, won AL Rookie of the Year, receiving 26 of 30 first place votes, and the other four votes were second place. So he beat the Yankees' Gary Sanchez, who essentially hit like Babe Ruth for 6 weeks, and the Indians' outfielder, Tyler Naquin. Great, awesome. You know, hopefully it's the start of a great career, because it kind of way a segue into the last Tigers pitcher to win Rookie of the Year. Well, was Justin Verlander back in 2006. Well, that things went a little differently with the Cy Young vote. One of the problems with this year's Cy Young vote is that there was not really one absolutely slam dunk candidate. There was about five or six pitchers who had legitimate cases for it, and maybe three or four, I think, who, if they won it, you wouldn't be upset about it. Well, one of those guys won it, and it wasn't Justin Verlander. It was Rick Porcello, of all people, who won 22 games with the Boston Red Sox. But if you look at the advanced metric type stats, Justin Verlander really did have a better year because, well, Rick Porcello, when he pitched, had the run support as if he had a beer league softball team playing. That's the kind of run support he got. While Verlander, I think, got like more than 2 runs less a game run support. And unfortunately, there's still a lot of, I guess I hate to put it this way, old farts in the Baseball Writers Association of America who look at wins as the be-all, end-all. So what happened with the vote, Verlander took the majority of first-place votes. He won 14 of 30. Porcello only had 8. But he ultimately lost the vote by 5 points, much helped by the mystifying oddity that is the baseball writers in Tampa Bay. Their ballots from Bill Chastain of Major League Baseball, MLB.com, I should say, and Fred Goodall of the AP, who was also reported, hadn't, I think, seen a game since August. They didn't even put Verlander on the ballot. And that there's no guarantee that he would have won the vote. But at the very least, that the fact that Verlander was not on the top five of either of their ballots when every other single ballot had Verlander on it, well, it's head-scratching at best, and it's moronic at worst. And even funnier, Chastain said he submitted his vote with a week left in the season. And on that final week, Verlander, I think, allowed one run in 14 innings with 20 strikeouts. And let's not even forget the fact Verlander led the league in strikeouts this year. So, and also the fact that Verlander was a horse. He had 2 more starts than any other pitcher that got votes for Cy Young. So, and the other very strange thing with the Tampa Bay votes, 7 went to pitchers in the East out of the 10 total.
Right.
So,
right.
And I guess the other oddity is this is the second time Verlander has fallen a close second in the Cy Young. He has actually lost the 2 closest Cy Young races to date, the other being when he lost, I believe, by 4 or 5. He lost by 4 points to David Price in 2012. I don't think anybody argues that David Price, or for that matter, Rick Porcello. It's just how it all went down, Greg. And just to kind of title a nice knot was Kate Upton went absolutely batshit insane on Twitter, raged, and I think let loose of, I think, is up there with the greatest all-time burns. when it comes to the baseball writers or anybody in particular. When she tweeted, I thought I was the only person allowed to fuck Justin Verlander. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that when it comes to a burn. So I guess in the end, Greg, this doesn't mean a hill of beans in the big scheme of things. So the Tigers still didn't make the playoffs. Justin Verlander still an elite pitcher. Rick Porcello probably just had his career year, blah, blah, blah. But Tigers fans really have a chip on their shoulder when it comes to this stuff, specifically because the Tigers are underrepresented in the Hall of Fame, you know, specifically because of what happened to Whitaker and Trammell. This is the second time Verlander could very easily be a three-time Cy Young Award winner. And then there's that always fear that, you know, with Trammell, the reason he didn't make the Hall of Fame because he got screwed out of the MVP in 1987 when the moron baseball writers gave it to George freaking Bell. So I think it comes down to a couple things. One, you know, Kate Upton, you know, being the superstar model that she is, she got a lot of attention with this. And two, Tigers fans, I think for decades, and I think reasonably so, think that the baseball writers, for the, you know, obviously things have changed somewhat over the last decade because of Miguel Cabrera and Verlander, but still, over the decades, I think the Tigers, more often than not, have been, for lack of a better word, dicked over by the baseball writers when it comes to this kind of thing. All right, I'm out of breath. It's all yours.
welcome to my world.
Yeah.
I think that what made this particularly bitter for the Tigers fans to swallow was the fact that Verlander got, I believe, six more first place votes than Porcello.
Six more.
I think he had 14, and I think Porcello had 8.
Yep.
And that's, you know, I mean, if you lose on points, which is what he did, of course, I mean, you lost on points, that's one thing. But when you have more first place, it's kind of like winning the, you know, we just had an election where one candidate won the popular vote, presidential election, and didn't win the Electoral College.
Right.
It's the same kind of a thing. It's like, boy, I had, you know, 75% more first place votes than you did.
Mm-hmm.
Yet I'm not the Cy Young guy, and that's probably what's got the dander up of Kate Upton et al. If Verlander was behind on points, but it's because he was like tied with first place votes, or maybe foresaw it a couple more. But Verlander, I saw those numbers. I was, wow, 14 he had.
Yeah.
But let's, you know, what I wish people would also try to remember is the fact that, and this is what I was kind of hoping also would enter into the voting with the writers, and I was hoping that this would, well, obviously it did with 14 of them because 14 of them took
right.
the first, but I was hoping that, you know, just the fact, sometimes I wish the fans could just be happy with the fact that the notion that Verlander even was a finalist for this award,
mm-hmm.
based on where he was, I believe in end of June, he was like 7-6 with a 4.30 ERA or something like that. You know, the Cy Young wasn't even in the hemisphere with him at that point. The fact that he was able to claw back from that start and work himself into the Cy Young conversation.
Mm-hmm.
To me, is the story. And to me, and the fact that he did it after several years of being less than what we expected out of him, and battling injury, and the core surgery, and on and on and on. You know, a lot of people wrote him off and said he's done, he's finished, he's through, he's too old, and you know, unfortunately, this controversy has kind of overshadowed what I think was leading up to the vote. Was kind of a feel-good story. Like, boy, here's Justin Verlander again, back in the Cy Young mix. You know, it almost would have been better, Al, if he had, like, finished a distant second or third, and there wouldn't have been all this controversy. You could just say, boy, we're just proud of him. We're proud that he was a finalist. We're proud that he got some votes. And look at what he's done. Look how far he's come. Given his age, given what he's gone through, that should have been the story. Unfortunately, the story kind of turned ugly. It turned into a controversial, mm-hmm. you know, divisive thing. And the Major League Baseball Writers Association of America, you know, they didn't look great. And they didn't look great with a couple other awards, too, by the way. And
right.
so it was like, well, so that whole part of the Verlander story just kind of got washed away by this negativity, and that was kind of a bummer, because I thought that this was supposed to be a feel-good thing, and it would have been great for him to win it. I was pulling for him to win it, of course. But I have to admit that when I woke up the next morning and I saw the results the way they were, I was a little taken aback as well. I mean, wow, you know, I didn't think he was going to get that many first-place votes versus the first-place votes that Porcello got. And this is, of course, nothing. This is not against Porcello whatsoever. I mean, you know, he's a great kid, and good for him. He's another good story, by the way. Who would have thought that he'd be a Cy Young winner after what, you know, we saw in Detroit? We all thought he was a 1.4 WAR guy, 4.2 ERA, 12 wins. I mean, that's what we thought he was. And he was pitching in a pitcher's ballpark. He goes over to Fenway Park, which is not a pitcher's ballpark, of course, and his lights out at home, and, you know, pitching for a division winner in the home nine yards, so good for him. But it's too bad that this whole thing got turned ugly. I agree with you that the Upton tweet was clever and was funny, but it just added to the rancor of the whole thing.
And I guess, and Tigers fans, you know, as we both are, should also remember that, you know, we consider ourselves damn lucky to have essentially been able to watch the career of a pitcher who, if he continues on the track he's on right now, should be a no doubt Hall of Fame pitcher. So, and if he pitches anywhere near the way he has over the past year and a half, you know, finally he's got all the injury issues out of the way. He looks like he could be a very effective pitcher for at the very least the remainder of his contract. I guess the question now is he going to be a Tiger for the remainder of his contract? Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your point of view, that's really, really quiet on that trade front right now when it comes to the trade rumors involving Verlander, or for that matter, Cabrera, Kinsler, J.D. Martinez. So I have a feeling maybe on a next podcast we may have a little more to talk about when it comes to that sort of thing, but... Yeah, right now, I wish Verlander would have won the Cy Young. In the big scheme of things, it doesn't mean that much.
Right.
But it's just another sign of that I think the BBWA, AA, needs to purge their membership. And for a long time, it didn't even allow internet writers into the BBWA. Oh, that's only changed in the last few years. And like I said, the two guys that had the vote for Tampa Bay, one of them barely even covered the team. That's the sort of stuff that's got to change. Unfortunately, I think that's not really going to happen, Greg, until when it comes to that kind comes to the baseball writers, the ones that have the power, so to speak, right now. That's not going to change till they start retiring, dying off, however you want to put it. And the new generation of guys come in here who are much more open to advanced metrics, are much more... they don't buy into traditional. He had 20 wins. Well, he got to get a Cy Young vote. That, you know, that kind of thing. That's not going to happen with the new breed of writers who know more to dive into the deeper numbers. So, I guess in the end, it really comes down to that, Detroit against the world kind of thing. And really, once again, this vote kind of fell into that category, like a lot of things seem to. When it comes to any time Detroit's involved in anything nationally.
Well, you know, I hate to think that there's an anti-Detroit bias, but I do agree with you that there, you know, I don't want to overreact either, but I think it's fair to look at who votes and look at membership and look at how these awards are doled out, because these are important. I mean,
yeah.
You know, you said it's not that important, the whole scheme of things, and you're right. I mean, really, none of it's important as far as that's concerned. I mean, even winning the World Series, I mean, if you really want to keep some perspective, none of this really matters. But
right.
Within the game, these things do matter to certain people. I mean, they really do. I mean, you can say, it's who cares? I mean, he still had a great year. He's still our guy, but. You know, I mean, Verlander clearly wanted to win. He was on pins and needles all day. He wanted to win this very badly. And it's not just it is a pride thing with the fans. I mean, the fans do want to have.
And as you said, a guy like Verlander has a huge ego. He wants to win these awards.
Yeah.
You're right. That's just
sure.
How, you don't
right. I mean,
get to
and
that
that's
level
fine
without having that kind of attitude. And that's fine.
So these things, I mean, yes, they're individual awards in a team sport. I understand that. But they've been given out for decades and years and years and years and years. And they are important. They are legacy things. And they are things that go on your permanent record, if you will. And they are things that can make a – sometimes, Al, can make or break a Hall of Fame vote.
Yep.
You know, you look down the line and guys voting for you for the Hall of Fame might look at, well, how many Cy Youngs did you win and how many MVPs did you win? And, you know, it may come down to – I mean, sometimes if you're one of these guys that's kind of, you know, a tweener, you're not really a first ballot person. You're one
Jack
of these guys
Morris,
that –
Jack Morris, for example. If Jack Morris, for example, had won a Cy Young, he's probably in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah. Well, hey, if Al, well, you mentioned the George Bell thing.
Yeah.
Well, if Trammell wins the MVP in 87 – does he get more consideration for Hall of Fame? Probably. So these things do matter. I mean, they really do. So it's fair to just – now with the – you mentioned not letting the online writers write or vote until recently. That's ridiculous. It's fair to just kind of take a look at who's voting for these things. You know, should some of them be purged? Should new blood come in? You know, can you – take metrics too far? Yeah, I think you can. I think you can, especially when it comes to MVP, which we're not even going to talk about today.
Right.
I think that, when it comes to Cy Young, which is strictly the best pitcher, I think it's fair to bring metrics and advanced metrics into the mix. I really believe that.
Yeah.
When you're doing MVP, I think that's a little bit too hawkish to just look at metrics. And I think if you look at the spirit of the MVP award and look at what the actual verbiage on the actual award says,
mm-hmm.
I think it kind of lends itself to more of a subjective kind of a thing where there are some intangibles involved.
Right.
But when it comes to the Cy Young, I think it's fair to dig deeper, like you said, into these numbers and say, look, okay, we know Porcello was plus 18 at 22-4, but let's dive deeper. Let's look at run support. Let's look at all these other advanced metrics that there are that the Brian Kennys of the world have cooked up. You know, I think it's fair to look at that kind of stuff when you're looking at it. And it's, to me, Cy Young is a purely individual award, purely individual. Whereas MVP, I think there are team components to that belie advanced metrics. But when it comes to Cy Young, I think it's fair to do that. So I also think it's fair to look at the people who are making these decisions and we ought not be voting with a week to go before the season ends. And, you know, because all that does, Al, it just,
mm-hmm.
even if it's not going to change the results entirely, all it does is it just invites more scrutiny and more vision where there shouldn't be. And all
mm-hmm.
you've done now by voting a week early is you've cast – an aspersion on all the BBWAA, just by you doing that. It's like these clowns who vote for the Hall of Fame who don't vote at all or who do goofy things with their ballots or let the fans vote, or like Dan Le Batard that one time, I'll let the fans vote. I mean, you know, either take this seriously or don't do it. I mean, you know, if you don't want to do it, then let somebody else do it. Who's going to take it seriously? And so I think that it's fair to look at these guys and say, who are we letting vote for this thing? And is it the best mix of people? Or should we really look at it and say, well, do we want to get the players involved? Do we want to get managers involved? I mean, you know, it doesn't have to be just the writers.
Yeah, to say the very least. And just to make a quick nod towards the MVP, yes, Mike Trout did win the MVP. His second of his career. And the interesting point about that is Trout has played 5 full Major League Baseball seasons. He has finished either first or second in the MVP vote every single year. That's freaking ridiculous.
That's amazing.
And the other thing I will throw out there about the MVP is Miguel Cabrera finished 9th in the AL MVP race. That means he has received at least one MVP vote every single year of his career. And
wow.
He is also, as a Tiger, He's only had 1 year as a Tiger where he didn't finish in the top. No, 2 years where he finished not in the top 10. He finished 13th his first year here and 11th last season. But regardless of that, I think both of those stats here are kind of remarkable for a guy who's starting to reach the twilight of his career, and a guy who is looks like he might be, he could, if he continues on his track, could be the best baseball player of all time. I found those two numbers interesting.
Yep, I agree.
All right, let's wrap it up. Who is your jerk of the week?
Well, I, you know, the NFL drives me crazy sometimes. I kind of a love-hate relationship with the NFL, but do we need to have a Monday night game in Mexico City? Do we need to be playing an NFL game in Mexico City? I'm already tired of these London games. I don't know why we need to be going to London to play NFL football. I don't know if there's a big thirst for football over there. If there is, then why don't they start their own damn league? If they want football so badly, why don't the Brits start their own league? Why do we need a football game, a tomorrow night's Monday night game, Houston against the Raiders, in Mexico City? I have no idea what that's all about. I don't know. You're taking a home gate away from one of the NFL teams, number one. I know the NFL is probably, and I'm sure they're being compensated somehow, one of those teams, or both, are being compensated somehow for taking their teams to Mexico City.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know why there's, is there a thirst for NFL football in Mexico City? Are they thinking of expanding to Mexico City? Why are we playing NFL regular season games, regular season games? Now, if you want to play a game in August in Mexico City, knock yourself out. You want to play in London in August, go ahead. I don't know why we're playing regular season games in foreign countries, and I just don't know why we're doing it. And here we are again, a big matchup, Houston against Oakland on essentially a neutral site, which is ridiculous. It should be in one of those teams' stadiums, fair and square, and I don't know why the NFL insists on playing games, staging games in other countries. I don't know what they're trying to prove. I don't know. I don't know what the end game is. I don't know who they're trying to satisfy. I don't get it. I just simply don't get it. So my jerk of the week is the NFL.
Well, and I could go in a few different directions, but I think I am going with NFL kickers. I'm going to say for the NFL because, well, today there was a new record set. You know, we've been talking about a lot of records on this podcast. Well, today there was a new NFL record set. There were more extra points missed in 1 week's worth of games ever. There were,
right,
I believe, 11 extra points either missed or blocked in today's game. And actually, it's not even over with yet. We still got the game going on tonight, and we got tomorrow night's game as well. But
right,
I remember talking. You know, there's a thing called chaos theory, or you know, where you know, just a change is made just to create change, essentially, you know, or to create, as they say, chaos. Well, when the NFL moved the extra point from a chip shot from the two, and now it's a 35-yard kick, well, that has really changed the NFL into kind of, can make it kind of a chaos league, because it's no longer a sure thing. And it's starting to cost kickers jobs. And I'm sure after this, there are going to be some changes made. For example, the Vikings got rid of Blair Walsh last week. Well, his replacement missed an extra point. Robbie Gould, who joined the Giants to replace their wife-beating kicker, he missed two extra points. You know, even good kickers like Matt Prater, he had one block today. I guess I just have to put it out there. NFL kickers got to up their game. So they're my jerk of the week for setting a brand new record for missed extra points.
You know, it's not just extra points too, Al. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they've missed a lot of just field goals.
Yeah.
I mean, and then not long ones either. I've seen a number of NFL games. There was that debacle, that tie game on between Seattle and was it the Cardinals, I think.
Oh, God, yes.
Absolute debacle.
Wasn't it ended up 6 or something like that?
Missing kicks left and right,
yeah,
and they were chip shots. I mean, closer than an extra point.
Yeah.
I don't have the numbers in front of me, like I said, but it seems like the NFL, I've watched a lot of the NFL this year, and I've seen a lot of missed field goals. Forget extra points. Missed field goals that have, and I know that, you know, these guys aren't perfect. They're not automatic. They're not going to make every kick. But I've seen a lot of 40 yards and closer kicks missed this year. I don't know what it is, but good call about that. You know, as far as the chaos, your chaos thing,
yeah.
You know, I think that, well, that's exactly what this was intended to do, of course,
yeah,
obviously. And there's no question about it. And, you know, it does add another element of strategy. And these, you know, as you know, these missed extra points that happen, way back in the first quarter, always seem to follow you throughout the whole game. They just seem to, you know, always they're like walks in a baseball game. They just seem to always come around to haunt you. In the end, and you know, you miss an extra point in the first quarter can throw the whole scheme of things off. Now the Lions today against Jacksonville both missed extra points. It was 9-9 at halftime, so both of the extra points that were missed canceled each other out.
Right.
But a lot of times, you know, that missed point, it's amazing how often that can change the perspective of whether or not you're going for a field goal at the end of the game or going for a touchdown, or whether you have to make a decision to go for two at some point, which, of course, is what the NFL wanted. They wanted to create drama, strategy, and whether you like it or not, mission accomplished.
Indeed. All right, let's wrap this up. So let's get out the thank yous and let's call the podcast. So the floor is yours, Brad.
Okay, thanks to everybody for listening. See you in 2 weeks on December the 4th. I want to remind everybody to follow the Knee Jerks on Twitter, at the Knee Jerks. Follow our blog, thenejerks.us. Our Facebook fan page is facebook.com/thenejerks. Follow me on Twitter, at Greg, you know. And my blogs, of course, are located on WordPress. Just Google Greg, you know, Out of Bounds, or Greg, you know, the Winged Wheeler, and you'll find my stuff there. Thanks to my lovely wife, Sharon. And thank you, Big Al, for making Sunday night so gosh darn fun.
Indeed, and I got to give you credit, Greg, because I wasn't sure I was feeling up to a podcast tonight just because, you know, I'm changing the weather has made my arthritis flare up, but you got me all fired up, so thank you.
All right, I'm glad.
And, of course, I want to send a thank you to my girlfriend Linda, who's been wanting me to talk wings, so we talked a lot of wings. I just don't know if she wanted to hear what we had to say. But with that, and also thank you to all the listeners out there. We really enjoy doing this, and please keep listening, keep coming back. All right, with that, let's call the podcast. So until this time 2 weeks from now, this is Al Beaton saying good afternoon, good luck, and aloha.
Ciao, everybody. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Good night.